Three fundamental things have to happen for a bill to become law in this country. On Healthcare Today, One Down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 4th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are many, many things that are going to change as the healthcare bill that the House passed today makes its way through the legislative process. For one thing, key senators said today they are not actually going to take up this bill. They're going to write their own. Thank you very much. But there is one constant in all the politicking that is going to be happening. The Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan agency set up by Congress, as you might have gathered by the name, to do what is known as score various pieces of legislation, give its considered estimates of the costs and impacts of this bill or that. The House GOP bill that was voted on today and passed was voted on and passed without a CBO score, without those who voted for it knowing exactly, in other words, what they were voting for. A CBO score is, we're told, expected next week sometime. Doug Elmendorf was running the CBO when the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, sometimes called, was being debated. He is now the dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
First of all, is it your understanding that this would be a totally new review for the CBO, a new score on this bill?
This bill looks different enough from the previous version that CBO will have to take its time and do a careful estimate. They'll build on what they did for the original version of this legislation, but they'll have to incorporate a number of new features.
Okay, so if I'm a staff economist or analyst at the CBO beavering away down in the basement somewhere, what am I looking
at? Actually, the fourth floor.
Fourth floor. What am I looking at?
You're trying to understand how the bill will change the incentives and opportunities facing state governments, employers, and individual families. So you're looking at what sorts of subsidies or penalties are available or are imposed on people who make certain choices. You're looking at what state governments can do to avoid some of the rules of the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. and how those state choices would then affect what individuals do.
Okay, so to those state choices, the Republicans in the House have made a very big deal of the idea of flexibility in this bill, both for states and for individuals. People having the freedom to choose or not choose health care, states having the freedom to choose or not choose to apply for waivers and all the like. How do you model that if you are on the fourth floor of the CBO building?
We have experience in different states at different times of changes in health care and health insurance opportunities, and we can use those to estimate how people respond. The biggest challenge is for changes of a sort we have not seen before, and then CBO has to put together whatever shreds of evidence it can collect to try to paint a picture of what will happen from some more dramatic change. So the change in the Americans Health Care Act would be a dramatic change. Some of that is undoing what happened in the Affordable Care Act, and CBO can look at what the health insurance market was like before the Affordable Care Act. But some of it is different, and CBO will do its best to pull together these shreds of evidence, as I said, from other situations and apply them to this new bill.
Acknowledging that you are not in the CBO business anymore, what is your best guess as to what the score is going to be when it comes out? And just to refresh people's memory, it was 24 million people losing or choosing not to have health insurance and something like $340 billion over 10 years being cut from the deficit.
My guess is that even more people would lose health insurance under this new bill, and that people with pre-existing conditions will not be protected in the way that they would have been under the previous version. But that's just a guess, and people should not think that just because I was CBO director that I can do the work that CBO does in my head, because I certainly cannot.
Absolutely, and I grant you that point. One more question, and then I'll let you get on with your day. A lot of what's going to happen with this bill is going to come after the vote. The House has voted. It's going to go through the Senate. There will then be, if it passes there and becomes law in some form, there will be regulations and all sorts of things. That, too, will affect the eventual impact, right? And would affect a CBO evaluation, although you guys don't do post facto stuff.
Yes, CBO will produce an estimate of this bill. then they will produce estimates of whatever bill the Senate takes up and whatever compromise bill might be reached between the House and Senate. But it is a terrible mistake for the House to proceed without a CBO estimate at this point. That just violates the very sensible norms of knowing what you're voting on before you vote.
Doug Elmendorf used to run the CBO from 2009 to 2015. He is now the dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard. Doug, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kai.
My interview with Keith Hall, by the way, the current director of the CBO from a couple of weeks ago, is at our website, marketplace.org. Look for that thing that says Heard on Air. I'm pretty sure that's it. On Wall Street today, healthcare bill? What healthcare bill? The major indices ended pretty much where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Story about the bond market now via Puerto Rico. As we have reported, Puerto Rico owes its creditors more than $70 billion and has thus far been unable to restructure that debt satisfactorily. The island's governor announced yesterday he is seeking court protection under Title III of what is known as the Promesa Act, a law passed last year appointing a financial oversight board, and in theory, it was designed as a way to get Puerto Rico out of debt. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been on that story for us for months.
Puerto Rico has two big problems, its debt and its legal status. It's a territory, so it doesn't have access to Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection, as a city like Detroit had when it got into hock a few years ago. Still, Title III sure sounds a lot like bankruptcy. Mary Ellen Tai has been covering this story for Debt Wire Municipals, a news service dedicated to distressed and high-yield bonds.
It's like saying Sprite and Coca-Cola are the same thing. Like, they're both soda, but there's a little difference.
The difference? That the proceedings will be held in federal district court, not bankruptcy court. Puerto Rico's government will be involved, the bondholders too. But so will Puerto Rico's Financial Oversight Board, appointed by the U.S. Congress. It's complicated, says Kate Long. She's represented the bondholders' interests for 5 years.
This is probably the most epic legal battle that will happen in the United States, you know, over the next 30 years or so.
So who's going to win?
Huge numbers of attorneys on both sides and advisors.
Well, sure, but Puerto Rico's government gets protection from lawsuits. The bondholders get some of their money back. This first filing applies only to about $18 billion of Puerto Rico's general obligation bonds, which are guaranteed by the Puerto Rican Constitution. The bondholders will take a haircut, but they already knew that. Do Puerto Ricans blame the bondholders or the government that got them into this mess?
Bondholders are not loved, but, you know, we certainly don't have criticism towards us, I think, that members of the government do.
Criticism over things like shuttered hospitals and schools and unmet pension obligations. This restructuring will be painful, but might at least offer Puerto Ricans a new hope. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
River levels in parts of the Midwest started falling today after a week or more of severe flooding there, but the crisis is far from over. Hundreds of people have been displaced, if not more, people who now have to figure out how to pay for the damage that was done. The National Flood Insurance Program does help homeowners buy affordable flood insurance, but it is a big money loser for the federal government. So, can you say public-private partnership? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer can.
Pretty much everyone agrees the National Flood Insurance Program needs an overhaul. The next chance to do that is this September, when Congress has to reauthorize the flood insurance program. The program is about $25 billion in debt because it's paid out much more than it's collected. Free market advocates like Ray Lehman of the R Street Institute say that's why Congress should encourage more private insurers to sell flood insurance at market prices.
Having the reminder that there is real risk at the coast is important. Those prices are there for a reason.
Right now, Lehman says, the government keeps flood insurance prices down for everyone who owns a home in a floodplain. That includes expensive beachfront homes. Lehman says the government should only give the subsidies to lower-income homeowners. But Laura Lightbody, who heads the Pew Flood Program, wonders if private insurers would want to sell to those homeowners.
So it is a tricky balance between rates reflecting risk and also not kicking people out onto the curb.
One of the flood insurance bills now in Congress would make sure that doesn't happen. Lower-income homeowners would get vouchers for private insurance. Carolyn Kuski is a fellow at Resources for the Future. She says, don't forget, the government can also reduce risk. making it less likely that people get flooded.
Elevating homes or moving people away and turning it over to open space or building all sorts of different structural protection.
Kuski says the government is doing a careful dance on flood insurance, wanting people to understand their flood risk and pay for that risk, but not squeezing out lower-income homeowners who don't want to leave their houses, even if they are in a floodplain. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
President Trump is making his first visit home to New York since his inauguration today, and his old neighborhood looks a little bit different, the neighborhood being Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, home to Trump Tower, of course, and some of the highest-end retail in the world. Gucci, Tiffany, Louis Vuitton name the brand, and they have a flagship store there almost certainly. But as Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains, there are some storefronts sitting empty right now.
If you come down the famous gold escalator at Trump Tower, step out through the revolving doors, you might just run into Tom Cusick.
Tom, thought that might be you.
How are you?
Cusick's president of the Fifth Avenue BID, the Business Improvement District. He's been the neighborhood's number one booster for 30 years, he says. So during the transition, when President Trump's security shut down traffic, that hurt.
What did that do to business on the avenue?
It tanked it. I don't know how else to say it. A minimum of $40 million was lost from just this area, about a two-block stretch.
Things have recovered a bit since Trump moved to Washington, but the sales hit came at a bad time. Roughly one of every six storefronts was already sitting empty, according to real estate firm Cushman Wakefield. Why?
A simple bubble in real estate rents.
Retail rent in New York has been climbing for almost 15 years, according to Nat Rocket. He's a broker at Marcus & Millichap, and he says when he was doing a deal on Fifth Ave in 2010, he was hoping to get $2,000 per square foot. 3 years later, that same space leased for over $3,000.
But even $2,000 a square foot was a massive number.
For a few years, fancy brands could afford the high rents. Then something else started happening.
The consumer is clearly transitioning their spending habits online.
Stacy Widlitz is an independent retail analyst. She says we're moving to a world where something like 30% of clothing sales will happen on the internet. So when it comes to a flagship store,
a lot of those leases now, the retailers are starting to rethink. They're the most expensive leases in the world, and maybe it's just not worth it.
Making things worse,
tourism is the big engine of what's known as high street retail, you know, the sort of the sexy retail locations.
Nat Rocket says tourists spend something like three times as much as locals at stores like these. And New York City expects 300,000 fewer tourists this year. So far, landlords are trying different things to entice tenants. A few months free, a little help building out the space. What they're not doing is lowering the rent. Rocket explains, from a landlord's point of view,
as long as I keep it vacant, there's at least the chance that the market could recover.
Retail leases are long, 10 or 20 years. So landlords are gambling. They'd rather lose a few months of rent now if they can secure high prices later, rather than have to lock in lower rents for decades. The danger, of course, is that the space never rents at all. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Coming up,
in terms of a whitewater year, this is going to rank in the top five in the last 30 years, probably.
Water, water everywhere and in a big snowpack up in the mountains, too. First, though, let's do the numbers. We're just going to call it flat. Flat is the word of the day. Everything down or up less than a 10% on Wall Street. So let's get to the healthcare vote and health insurers. United Health up 0.9%. Today, Cigna down about 0.1%. Aetna diagnosed a gain of about 0.8%. Viacom reported higher than expected revenues today. Shares, however, this being capitalism, still dropped 0.7% on news that popular channels had moved to a higher-priced cable tier. Competitors Disney down 0.4%. Time Warner down 0.7%. Volkswagen again seeing strong profits after using its diesel crisis to push through some tough restructuring and cost cuts. Volkswagen up 0.4%. Today, bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. British Prime Minister Theresa May has two political fights on her hands, one expected to be a good deal easier than the other. She's called a special election for early June, looking for a fresh mandate as she heads into Brexit negotiations. She's up 20 points in some polls over the opposition Labour Party. But there endeth the easy part. Talks with the soon-to-be 27 remaining member states of the European Union are going to last as long as 2 years and will be some very rough economic sledding. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
Launching her campaign outside No. 10 Downing Street, Prime Minister May said she called the election to strengthen her hand in the Brexit talks.
I say it is necessary to secure the strong and stable leadership the country needs to see us through Brexit and beyond.
Her critics here at Westminster suspect a more cynical motivation. Tom Baldwin is a former strategist for the opposition Labour Party. He says May wants to lock in another term before the horrible truth about Brexit begins to dawn.
She knows Brexit is going to be a disaster. She knows it's not going to be a land of milk and honey. And so she's cutting and running before reality bites for Brexit.
It's already clear that Brexit is not going to be a cakewalk. In Brussels this week, one news report suggested that Britain's bill for leaving the EU would top $100 billion. Speaking at a news conference yesterday, the bloc's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, wouldn't confirm that figure, but he was not about to reassure Britain either.
Some have created the illusion that Brexit can be concluded quickly and painlessly. This is not the case.
Off the record, EU officials have been much ruder. They've called Theresa May deluded and living in a different galaxy because apparently she said that Britain shouldn't pay a penny to leave the club. At a news conference on the campaign trail, May reacted.
I'm not in a different galaxy, but I think what this shows is that there are going to be times when these negotiations are going to be tough. And that's why you need strong and stable leadership in order to get the best deal for Britain.
And that, she says, is why she needs to win big in the election. But some close observers of the EU say that wouldn't strengthen her hand over Brexit. John Springford of the Centre for European Reform.
I think that a much bigger majority for Theresa May is unlikely to change anything about the rest of the EU's negotiating stance.
Maintaining free trade between Britain and the EU after Brexit could be mutually beneficial. But Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister and veteran of many bruising encounters with EU officials and politicians, doesn't think it's going to happen.
You know, the powers that be in Brussels, their greatest nightmare is a mutually advantageous agreement with Britain.
Because, he says, it might encourage other member states to head for the exit. The UK must suffer, even though it's one of the best export markets for the rest of the EU.
They're perfectly capable of inflicting major damage upon Britain and upon themselves.
In the general election on June the 8th, Prime Minister May seems set for an easy victory as tough-talking Theresa. But as for the Brexit talks, due to start soon thereafter, John Springford is very pessimistic.
You think it is perfectly possible then that these talks could collapse?
I think it's perfectly possible. There's a 50-50 chance that the whole thing collapses.
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
guy out here in California whose actual job title is Chief Snow Surveyor. Though he probably does enjoy hiking around up in the mountains, it's not all fun and games. The snowpack in California mountains holds as much as a third of the state's fresh water in a normal year. And this has not been a normal year. So Monday, when Frank Gerke, he's the surveyor, when he went up to Phillips, California, and dropped his ruler down into the snowpack to get the final read of the season, it was a big number.
We had a depth of snow of 49.5 inches, 190% of its long-term May 1 average.
Almost twice as much this year as normal. Money in the snowbank for businesses that are downstream. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
All right, one, two, three.
Whitewater rafters hoist their gray boat onto their shoulders, lifting it out of California's Kern River in the Sierra Nevada mountains. It's a group training to work as rafting guides.
It was gnarly. It was good. Splash.
Marin Roberts hopes to lead her first rafting season this summer for Kern River Outfitters. The water's so gnarly, so good, because so much snow fell this winter. Now it's melting. Roberts practices throwing rescue rope into the rapids from shore.
I threw and I missed, but that's okay. You know, practice makes perfect.
This is the first time in years Kern River Outfitters expects to employ a full staff for rafting season. This winter, through the company, a lifeline. Matt Volpert owns Kern River Outfitters, along with his brother. Their parents started the business. For 30 years, things flowed steadily. Then, California's massive drought.
2013, we got cut short, and then 2014, nothing, and then 2015, nothing. So that was kind of an eye-opener.
Nothing means no trips, refunds on bookings, a shuttered business. He's been watching the weather, his prospects for rafting getting better and better with every inch of snow.
Just knowing that you're about to hit the guaranteed land where it's like, okay, we will have not just a rafting season, but a terrific one.
In California, winter snow is good for all outdoor recreation, really. And there's a lot of that. But spring runoff is even more crucial for agriculture. And think of the snowpack as a frozen reservoir that will deliver water in spring when farmers need it. Climate change means a warmer planet where more precipitation will fall as rain, too early in the year to be useful. Matthew Sturm researches snow at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The delivery of the snow, which was so beautifully matched to sort of our needs, is going out of sync with our needs, coming more as water.
Water that will need to be stored behind dams as it falls, not naturally deposited to be saved for later, in a snowbank. Sturm co-authored a recent paper that looks at the economic value of snow. Michael Goldstein was also a co-author. He teaches finance at Babson College. He says as less snow falls, we'll have to rely more on groundwater. If things get to the point that there's no snowpack, no standing supply of snow, the downstream costs will be extreme.
If all this is going to disappear within, say, 15 years, that we are 20 years even, it's about $1 trillion.
That's a conservative estimate of how much all the water stored in snow is worth. And that's just for the western United States. Banner winters like this last one are worth tens of billions of dollars in water. But, Sturm says,
this is probably a temporary reprieve, not a full stay of sentence, if you will.
This year, rafting company owner Matt Volpert is just enjoying the ride.
In terms of a whitewater year, this is going to rank in the top five in the last 30 years, probably.
His calendar's already filling up with reservations. More snow also means a longer season. Revenue could increase by 30 to 50%. But Volpert says that extra money will have to go in the bank and to repay his parents. He and his brother bought the business from them last year.
Hopefully I can pay myself, you know, and then I also have to pay off the company, too.
He knows that drier days are in the future. That's why he wants to expand to other locations, rivers that are more sure to get their snow melt. That'll help him spread the risk and better weather changing conditions. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out with an eye toward the calendar. I learned two things today. Number one, that Mother's Day is Kentucky Fried Chicken's busiest day of the year. A 40% sales bump, the company says. While that and what it means sinks in, seriously, let it sink in. Item two goes like this. To mark Mother's Day this year, KFC has published a romance novel. It is called, I kid you not, Tender Wings of Desire. So please allow us, if you would, a brief reading and dramatization.
Finally, Madeline realizes Harlan isn't quite who she thought he was. He's no sailor. He's Colonel Sanders.
Yes, I'm a colonel. Yes, I'm fabulously rich. I'm a magnate of the restaurant industry, my dear. The king of an empire that I built with my bare hands. I took a sabbatical from my duties in order to see the world, see what else could possibly be out there. And on the course of my journey, I found what I was looking for.
Her heart fluttered wildly in the space of his pauses. In spite of everything, she found herself hanging on his every word.
I found you, Madeline.
Can't make this stuff up. Marketplace Michelle Philippi, listener Pete Connors, reading from, once again, KFC's romance novel. It's called Tender Wings of Desire. Flat all the way around on Wall Street today. The Dow off less than a 10%, 6 points. NASDAQ gained less than a 10%, 2 points. S&P 500, wait for it, gained. Yeah, less than a 10%, just over a point. I guess you didn't really have to wait, did you? John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for the time being is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.